Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning. You're very welcome to the show. Before we meet our panel, let's have a look at the front pages. And look, obviously, a lot of election. But in fact, a lot of the front pages are still dominated by the Conor McGregor rape case, or more properly by the survivor and the woman who stood up to Conor McGregor, Nikita Hand. So the front page of the Sunday Times: McGregor has scarred Nikita for life, says her mother, and that's Nikita Hand's mother, Debbie Hand, talking to them. The Irish Mail on Sunday: I knew that I would win, I simply told the truth, and that's Nikita Hand speaking to the Mail on Sunday. The Sun: Nikita, a voice for change. Taoiseach, McEntee and Rape Crisis Centre hail brave mum's fight. And the Mirror then has raging McGregor's online rant. And indeed, Conor McGregor was busy on Twitter and social media yesterday. The Business Post then is leading with politics. Incredible risk, multi-billion euro holes in main party plans. So basically what they've done is they're saying if you took out the what we categorise as windfall corporation tax, where would the spending plans of the various parties stand, the main parties? And they're saying Sinn Féin would be short 85 billion over the next 5 years, Fine Gael will be short 56 billion and Fianna Fáil will be short 55 billion. And we are all aware that if we took out the windfall taxes, we would be running big deficits instead of the big surpluses we're running. And as we know, the Americans are becoming aware of this as well. The Sunday Independent has a poll, and we will come to that in detail, but the headline is Harris Hop, now history as Fine Gael falls 4 points in tight race. Okay. Our panel this morning: Jennifer Bray is a political reporter with the Irish Times. Sheena Cahill is an account director at DHR Communications. Bobby McDonough is a former ambassador to the UK and the EU. And Professor Gary Murphy is professor of politics at DCU. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Sheena Cahill, can I come to you first? You've been looking at the widespread coverage of the Conor McGregor rape case.
Yeah. I think firstly to say the coverage has been everywhere, and it's been very overwhelming, Brendan, to be honest with you. I think that you will find, certainly for me, but I think a lot of people I know, a lot of sadness and a lot of hurt and a lot of frustration and anger, then an avoidance entirely maybe of the media. And then
Are you talking about for the last two or three weeks, Brendan? Every day we got all these details.
Constantly, kind of a blink, kind of constant up coverage coming at us from every direction. I think...
Was it excessive?
I felt it was, I'm going to be honest. I know that there's a difference here between a criminal case and a civil case, and it was a civil case. But I suppose that it did feel like there was an approach to this, a kind of a constant updating, kind of live, kind of blogging style.
That because of the involvement of Conor McGregor?
Because of someone famous, yeah, absolutely. And I know that that's, it's of interest to the public. Whether it is in the public interest, I think maybe is something maybe I'm trying to think about at the minute. But certainly I think there was a relief, Brendan, from people this week. You know, certainly from people like me. I work and support the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre and their services as a board member. But there was no jubilance in what we got back. I mean, I think the consequences and the impact of the last 3 weeks of a trial and just how public that was, the damage that that has done, goes far beyond maybe the steps of the court. I mean, and I think, you know, we've talked a lot over the last couple of days, particularly about that importance of truth, about believing victims. But I sound like a broken record, Brendan, when I say that I think that we have to come to some kind of reckoning in this country about our behaviours and attitudes towards kind of sexual relationships and what we understand consent to be. And I think it was really important, in fact, probably quite historic, for it looking at the judge's direction to the jury in this case, kind of, I suppose, pleading with them to look at consent as something that is active, that's ongoing, that's mutual. It's not something about what text you send, what Instagram story you put up, what you happen to be wearing. And it may be easy actually for a lot of people to turn away from this week and say, you know, somebody larger than life, someone so famous as the person that was there, someone who might be in kind of fighter kind of background, it nearly seems kind of more inevitable, that kind of really kind of toxic masculinity, that might be associated with violence and sexual violence. But I think it's too easy to step away from that and not think further about the consequences of not having conversations about consent much earlier in our schools and in our homes. And like, obviously, this is the conversation that's happening today and this week and the last 3 weeks, bombarding our airwaves and bombarding our screens because this person is famous, because people from all over the world are interested in them. But the conversation goes right back and goes so much earlier to every single one of us about consent. And
is there any argument, Sheena, to be made, what you were saying about the coverage earlier? Like, I don't know, but is there an argument to be made that actually the coverage and then the way it has crystallised in, as you say, the judge's comments in the decision of the jury and everything, has been a huge education possibly for a lot of young men? And like, I think most people, they were reading it, but with revulsion.
I would like to say that would be correct, Brendan, but actually what we have seen is a rise in victim blaming attitudes, actually, unfortunately.
OK, is that the reality?
And that is the reality. So while absolutely there are people who are reading it with revulsion, and so many of us are, there have been people, you know, looking at it and kind of really kind of considering all of those details about her presentation, her life, her background, everything, every decision that she made, and making assumptions about that, and because it's been so public. So look, the reality is the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre calls to their helpline increased by 20% over the first 10 days of the trial. What came up in a lot of those conversations with our services was that there was an increase in victim blaming attitudes from people. So there was, you know, an increase of 50% first time callers to the service who'd never called before, who've probably had an experience of sexual violence in their past. And a lot of people who call the service, it's not something that happened last night. It was something that could have happened years ago or weeks ago. Court will never be something for many people who call a service like that. But what will live with them and what continues to stay with them day in, day out, and this is men and women, is the attitudes of the people around them. That when you respond to something that comes up on TV or on Twitter or wherever, and the attitude you have to the victim or survivor in this case, that goes far beyond that one interaction, because you don't know who you're talking to. And if you take it into account that most women in their lives in this country will have been impacted in some way by sexual violence, then you have to take it, you must take it, regardless of who you are, that the people around you have experienced it perhaps in some way, and your attitude should reflect that. And of course, this has been an education, but I think for many people, it may even have bolstered how they feel actually about the fact that, you know, for them, what you wear or how you put yourself in a particular situation meant that you were in a position of asking for it, or you were in a position where you made it out like you wanted something to happen sexually. We know very, very clearly that consent cannot be given if you're under the influence of significant amounts of alcohol, like was in this case. But this has to be something we have to reckon with, and it has to be in every home. And today, if you do one thing, have that conversation, you know, with your sons and with your brothers and the lads in your group. And when you see stuff happening, when you see things said, call it out, say something. And for anyone listening who needs support, please reach out for it, because, you know, there are so many people there who want to listen to you.
Okay, thank you. And just on one point, to be absolutely clear about it, there was no question here of that the reason she could not consent was because of drink or drugs. It was not a technicality. She did not consent.
Absolutely.
She made it clear she was not consenting. Jennifer, what do you think?
To be honest with you, I'm so alarmed to hear that there has been an increase actually in victim blaming attitudes. I have detected that as well, that element of kind of judgment. I didn't know that there'd been an increase and it horrifies me to hear that. I do think one of the other things, though, that will resonate from what's happened over the last number of days is Nikita's message that she delivered, which is to use your voice. I actually think there's a huge amount of women who will find that really, really empowering. And the strength and bravery that she showed, I think, has resonated with me personally, obviously, as a woman, but with swathes of Irish women. I mean, the reaction to this that I've seen amongst women that I know in my friend groups has been phenomenal. And also the support that she seems to have received in terms of letters from the public. It's just such a relief to hear that that is the case. And I think that message that she relayed outside the courts, use your voice, you have a voice, I think that will live on. I think that's a tremendous legacy for her to
And we want to hear more from the lads in our life, Brendan. Like what I was seeing even on my social media was all the girls in my life, a lot of them kind of putting it out, putting up the kind of sharing, in journalist stories, sharing the news. And there was a kind of a sense of relief. But we want to hear more from the guys. And I know that a lot of lads feel very stressed by this because they don't want to say the wrong thing. But we want to hear from you, I think, is my message. We want you to be part of this conversation and how we can make it better for everybody. And I just want to note as well, the court accompaniment service by the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre was with Nikita every single day of this trial, because in a lot of cases, I mean, we often see these cases as being criminal trials where the victim or sexual survivor is actually there as a witness, not as it was in this case with Nikita as the plaintiff. But we are there to support. So if anyone does need help or needs to reach out, please contact the DRCC.
And Nikita Han made a point of mentioning Cliona, a woman called Cliona from the Rape Crisis Centre who was there with. And indeed, in a criminal rape trial, often, as you say, the actual victim is there as a witness and does not enjoy huge support in on that level a lot of the time either. Gary, I've noticed a lot of women of our vintage feeling that this has been an eye-opener for them too. They're looking back on the different times that we grew up in and on things that happened as well and going, actually, you know what, this changes how I view things that happened 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah, I think the main thing I've taken out of it is the extraordinary courage of Nikita Han, simply to relive the trauma that she went through on that night and in the aftermath of it, seemed to me extraordinarily powerful. And it's a very good piece by Eilish O'Hanlon in the Sunday Indo and by Brenda Power in the Sunday Times commending her, and I would add my voice to that. I mean, McGregor is world famous, and which is to go to Sheena's point about the excessive coverage. I mean, it was the first story on the ESPN app, like an American sports global giant. So the courage to take on a man like that in this civil case, and also you have the risk of costs hanging over her, that if everything was found against her, and much shows really the most amazing courage. And you're right in terms of people of our age who would have grown up in a different world without social media. I just found it, to go back to Jen's point, empowering in one way to listen. I have a daughter roughly her age, and I think that bringing people up to show such courage is really it's important. I also have a son in his early 20s, and I would have thought, I would have hoped that I would have brought him up and people like us to understand what consent is and to show respect to people when they're on a night out, which I hope we have. Because Sheena is quite right. Men need to talk about this as much as women. But in my friend groups, which are different to maybe Jen's and Sheena's, the overwhelming consensus, I think, is good for Nikita Han to have the courage to stand up, to get vindicated, and that we do need to talk about how young men behave, and hopefully we can help them to behave in the appropriate manner when they're out and about, in their daily lives.
Bobby?
I don't have much to add to Sheena and Jennifer, who are very articulate. But I think we should also recognise that we're fortunate to have independent courts where people can have their rights vindicated, even when the perpetrator is a very famous person. The jury sat through the whole trial and reached a very clear decision on it. And the other thing I'd add is just a slightly different angle, but I'm struck in recent times by how many sports people, GAA, soccer, rugby, martial arts, have been charged with violent crimes or fraud or even theft. And I think some of them probably believe they can walk on water. Having said that, of course, most sports people are admirable and are role models. But it's a pity when a small number of them, because they think they can walk on water, let down the reputation of many of their fellow sports people.
Yeah. Sheena, do you want to give us the last word on that?
Yeah, I just want to say that if anyone has been kind of impacted by what we've been talking about, and I think for a lot of people, there will be things to chew over, not just this morning, but throughout the week. The Dublin Rape Crisis Centre operates a 24-hour helpline at 1-800-778-888.
OK. Can I just ask one more question? That just, it strikes me as everyone talking here about the bravery of Nikita Hand, and Jennifer, you had noted the piece with her mother on the front page of the Sunday Times saying this will impact her forever. And look, in one way, the money, I think a lot of people thought she should have got a lot more. Yeah. But no money can in any way compensate for not just what she went through that day, but the 6 years, the last 2 weeks, all of it, right? Does this have any impact on Conor McGregor, does anyone think?
Yes, it has to have an impact on Conor McGregor. How could it not? I think the extent to which it has an impact is an open question. And, you know, he's a successful businessman. He is an international sportsman. He is recently now an actor, for which he made a lot of money in his acting debut. And I think the conversation is moving on to what is the impact. I note that on the front page of the Sunday Independent today, the Rape Crisis Network are urging retailers to stop selling some of his alcohol brands. And I also note that there's this movement online, which I've noticed over the weekend, of driven by women primarily, I will say, encouraging people to unfollow him on social media. And right, that sounds like a really small thing, right? Unfollowing someone, what's that going to do? Actually, apparently, it could do a lot. There were figures, and they're gone from the top of my head, but that show the more followers you have, obviously, the more money you make. And so there are movements like that. Now, quite how far they get and how successful they are, honestly, Brendan, I don't know.
But he is a man with no humility, it seems to me. And there's a very good piece by Éilis O'Hanlon, as I said, on the back page of the Sunday Indo, drawing the comparison with the trial in Northern Ireland a few years ago of
But
the point is, in the aftermath of that trial, those who were on trial and they were acquitted regretted what happened on the night, no matter the different perspectives on the night, whereas McGregor has offered no regret for anything that happened or the upset that Nikita Hand has clearly and the trauma that she has gone through, notwithstanding how the verdict went. So he is a man without humility, it seems to me.
Yeah. I just one before we leave it, one broader issue there, Sheena, is that, you know, we're saying well, this should have an impact on Conor McGregor's reputation, career, everything else. You can't help but think there's a president in America today who had a massive civil sexual assault taken against him. A guy nearly became head of their whole justice system who seems to have serious questions to answer around
It's nearly a question of which of them don't have a question to answer, particularly over sexual assault at this point. I think that this case and the conversation we've been having for the last couple of weeks, and hopefully may continue in a kind of an open way in the next couple of weeks, about kind of sexual assault, violence in our society, all of that. I'd love to hope that sees a shift in attitudes, but unfortunately, from what I can see, there is a very well established glorification of a type of male culture, particularly for young guys, that looks up to lads like McGregor, like others who have the girls and the cars and the money, and ultimately they're also incredibly talented sports people. Regardless of the fact that I know nothing about his sport, that's probably fair to say. And what I would, you know, Jen mentioned about the unfollowing on socials. Like, will we see a drop in people showing up to him performing? Will we see a drop in young lads looking up to him? And I fear that might not be the case. So I think
everybody listening needs to have some very honest conversations now, particularly with the young people in their lives, but also with themselves if they are still following people like that who okay. perpetuate incredibly, incredibly vicious attitudes towards women. And like, the top line attitude of kind of an attitude towards women doesn't feel, it feels really, really far away from rape and sexual assault or assault and violence, but it's not as far as we think. And ultimately, we need to have some conversations about that. I don't think we're going to see a drop in it, but I think the conversation needs to continue.
Okay, we'll take a break. Our panel staying with us, Jennifer Bray, Sheena Cahill, Bobby McDonough and Professor Gary Murphy. Welcome back. Our panel are still here. Jennifer Bray, Sheena Cahill, Bobby McDonough and Professor Gary Murphy. So, Gary, on the election, I suppose the most immediate story in front of us is the outgoing Taoiseach's meeting with Charlotte Fallon, which has now been viewed millions of times. I think there's a piece in the Irish Mail on Sunday. He made me feel like a stupid girl.
Just a terrible moment for the Taoiseach, who I think has been lauded for his interactions with the public, but it went completely pear-shaped on Friday night in Kanturk in North Cork, when he had an interaction with Charlotte Fallon, as you said, who is a carer with the St. Joseph's Voluntary Charity for People with Disabilities. And maybe the most damning thing to come out of that was her statement that quote, "You're not a good man," which, I mean, for any of us to be told that by a person would make your heart type of sink. On the campaign trail, it's in one way it's easier to be in opposition, where you can say, things are terrible and I'll make things better. It's very difficult then when you're in government, and Fine Gael have been in government, as we all know, for close to 14 years, going for a record fourth term in office, although their seats have, as we know, declined by 55, I think, in the course of that that period of time. We have to see how it will play with the voters. We have a poll, obviously, in today's Sunday Independent.
Yeah, we'll come to that.
Yeah, showing, yeah. But showing Fine Gael down and the Harris Hop gone. But a very difficult moment for him. He expressed regret and apologised to Charlotte Fallon, but it was a very bad look when you see him sort of walking away, as distinct from just listening out to Charlotte Fallon and taking on her on board her dissatisfaction. So it's one thing to wander around the country and shake hands and, you know, take the good times, but when people are upset with you, you have to take it. Now, he handled his interaction with Ciarán Allen of People Before Profit the previous week, okay, very well, I thought, where he stuck out his hand and Mr. Allen wouldn't shake his hand, who was a well-known sort of political activist, and literally stayed to the end. But walking away from Charlotte Fallon, as we see in today's Mail and across the papers, she is very upset. And like that comment, "He made me feel like a stupid girl." I mean, if I was in Fine Gael today, you'd be holding your head in your hands.
Yeah. Jennifer, you spoke to Charlotte Fallon yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I saw this clip on Friday night and I honestly was immediately struck by it. I thought, my first thought was, this is a really, really bad look.
Couldn't avoid it on Friday night.
No, you could. It was everywhere. And at that stage, I think it had been viewed less. I think it was around 800,000, but it was really catching fire. And then yesterday morning, I set about kind of trying to contact Charlotte Fallon and got in contact with her before lunchtime. When I spoke to her, she was literally just off the phone with Simon Harris. So she said, "I have just hung up the phone with Simon Harris." And on one hand, she did appear to accept his apology. You know, she said that he's a human being at the end of the day. He said, "I was completely wrong. I was too harsh. You were just trying to do your shopping. I'm really sorry." On the other hand, she stands by the points that she made, which notably are that Section 39 organisations are really, really struggling, and that there's a huge number of workers who are leaving for a variety of different reasons. And she does genuinely feel that carers were not properly looked after in the budget and haven't been a priority for the government. And the last thing that she said to me on the phone was, I'm not going to deny it, it was horrible, that she wouldn't want anyone else to go through it, that she left through the back of the store, she was crying, she was shaking, and she was really, she was almost kind of worrying what people were saying about her. And I'd kind of said to her, well, look, I think actually the person who has the most questions to answer, obviously, is Simon Harris, and he rang her to apologise, to his credit. And I think two things about this. Number one, as a human being, I can understand that actually, if you're out meeting thousands and thousands of people, at the end of the day, these things can happen. But that is the danger, I think, of putting yourself out there morning, like the afternoon, the night, all the time, is that tiredness creeps in. And in my experience of general election campaigns, when tiredness creeps in, serious mistakes are made, slip-ups happen, gaffes happen, and these are the things that people remember. They don't remember what's on page 25 of your manifesto, but they remember how they felt when they watched you walk away from the carer.
Yeah, Bobby, do you think that's true, that like one little unfortunate moment like that, it has cut through? Does something like that cut through maybe in a way that all the varying numbers on houses and guards and stuff doesn't?
Well, it can do. I think this election has been largely about promises, which are very difficult to compare to each other, and about a number of gaffes, which have been a little bit on the Fine Gael side, because we had the Michael O'Leary thing as well. But we don't really know whether it will cut through. I mean, today's independent poll, presumably, which was taken before this incident, yeah, doesn't show much change.
No, but it was. It was taken on Thursday and, yeah, Friday. I suppose, are people thinking like, is there something in people that, yes, there are all these policies flying around, but they're kind of always thinking, do I like the cut of this guy's jib or not? And if they see a moment like that, as Jennifer says, how it makes them feel.
I think that the promises are so difficult to weigh against each other that a lot of people will vote on the basis of the flavour of the promises, on the capacity to deliver, but also on the personalities that are running in their constituency.
I think
tend to think that a lot of people haven't made up their mind yet.
Yes.
That's where a gaff like this can come in, because last time around, 10% of people decided on the day itself.
And 25%, in the last week. So if you're undecided and you see that, you'd say, oh, yeah, typical Fine Gael sort of arrogance, I'm going to vote for somebody else. And that's the big danger.
So Bobby, without jumping to the poll then, because I just want to keep that kind of ring fenced for now, this could go in any direction, you think?
The election?
You think people
I don't think the polls are completely wrong. That would be surprising. But I do think that people always act out of mixed motivation. I don't think when people go into vote in the polling booth, they may say, want to vote for one of the big centrist parties, but they may also be concerned about the environment, or they may want to have Sinn Féin, you know, to get a change of government, but they might also like to see Labour coming up a little bit. So, you know, I think a lot of people have mixed motivation.
Or they might look up at a poster and just have a flasher going, that fella's face is really annoying me. Like,
I think it happens more than we think. Do you know what's it? I think, you know, when we talk about this gaff between Harris and Charlotte, for me, I think it cuts through. Mandy Johnson, the Business Post, using the term uninspired about the election campaign. Gary Murphy, whose presence with us today, referring to the election as dull. Alison O'Connor saying not election campaign won't be remembered as one for the ages, and in the editorial of the Times, that referring to the campaign as lackluster. And I think, because certainly pundits and the media seem to be very bored by the election campaign for the last couple of weeks altogether, though I don't know how they are with having to run round circles trying to follow them around the country. But with all of that happening, it is absolutely like a space. It is ripe for things like that to happen, where someone on the campaign trail like that, and that one moment of mishandling in that instance, where, like, what he turned on was when she told him she didn't feel he was a good man, and he just turned. That was it. He just decided, I'm actually not dealing with this anymore. And you can see why that happened. But of course, with 5 cameras in your face and a gaggle of journalists, you're absolutely flipped. And Charlotte was dead right to get her points across to him. And I think, you know, importantly, I think it led to, and this is something you can't plan for, a conversation around carers and Section 39 workers, which is really important.
Let's be very clear as well that it's kind of the carers, we're often referring to people who are family carers, but these are people who work in these organisations.
Section 39. And also, could I say this, no disrespect disrespect to anybody on the panel.
Have you been bored?
No, this is what I was going to say. Yeah. I think this is a hugely consequential election. I haven't been bored for a second.
Okay, so you've picked a piece actually, Jennifer, the Sunday Times, The Clock is Ticking and the Fight to Power by Claire Scott. So you've been out for the last week. Give us a sense of, like, what are the forces out there? What are you picking up from the voters that are talking to politicians and everything else? What's the ground game?
The ground game, honestly, and I've been out canvassing. I've been following the different parties. I think, honestly, I do think that a lot of people haven't properly tuned in up until this point, and that's actually kind of normal in an election campaign. My impression is that. And I did wonder, would this be the case in the beginning? And actually, I was wrong in the beginning because I thought it wouldn't. The American election led immediately into the Irish election. And I think when you see the people that Donald Trump are appointing to his front line positions, his commerce secretary coming out and saying, Ireland's running a surplus. What's the story with that? We're coming for the corporation taxes. I think people are a little bit more anxious about the future than they were before. So that's something that I'm detecting coming up in the campaign. The other thing is, I think people kind of checked out when they thought, okay, you know, some of the drama went out of it in the summer because we saw what happened with Sinn Féin. They probably won't get in, is what people were thinking. It'll probably be those two again. And what's the point of engaging on that basis? But at this point of the campaign is when you see the race tighten. These final few days are absolutely pivotal. The debate on Tuesday has the potential to be historic. Yeah. It also has the potential to be boring, but I don't think it
the
will
be. The final feisty five, I think someone had it as.
Yes, yeah. And I think it's this week will be so tense, and I think it'll be anything but boring. But my impression is people want more reassurance, and they are not impressed with being, as our readers panel described it, bribed with our own money.
Okay, really, yeah? Mm-hmm. That's what you're getting back from panels. Interesting. Okay, well, look, that's as good a point as any to... I'll just give a quick rundown of... Look, there are lots of polls. They're all a snapshot in time. I'll again repeat what I said 2 weeks ago about a poll. I was reading a pollster recently who said that pollsters should be more honest about what a poll is. He said what they are is fuzzy ranges, okay? So bear in mind that the margin of error on this one is plus or minus 2.6. So that in either direction gives you a fuzzy range of 5%, okay, on each of these numbers. So they are really only kind of a suggestion. The samples, it was conducted Thursday and Friday, as I said. The sample size was 420 and the margin of error you have. And the changes indicated, this is from the Sunday Independent Ireland Thinks last poll, which was, I think, 2 weeks ago. Okay, so Fine Gael are down 4 in this on 22%. Sinn Féin are up 2 on 20%. Fianna Fáil are at no change on 20%. Independents and others on 19%. They are up 3. Aintu up 2 to 5%. Social Democrats down 1 at 5%. Labour 4%, no change. Green Party down 1 at 3%. And People Before Profit Solidarity, no change at 2%. So, Bobby, you had picked the poll and the front page story out of it. I think the bit you're interested in here is there are four blocks, if we look at this poll here, and the fourth one there, independents and others, 19%, this poll suggests.
Yes, a lot of people make the case for independents, and there are some excellent independents in the current Oireachtas, and I'm sure there will be in future. But we have approximately 1 in 5 voters saying they're thinking of voting for independents. And we have an electoral system that favours independents because of, you know, the multi-seat constituencies. And I just think there is a case to be made also for political parties, not just for the individual political parties who are campaigning, but for political parties in general. Maybe in people's constituencies, the best candidate is an independent, fair enough. But I think political parties make it easier to form governments that will last and deliver a programme for 5 years.
You sound
years.
Like you were delivering a Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael message there. I think
no, not
particularly
no, not at all, Brendan,
Harris
because
has been trying to put this message out. Don't vote for an independent if
I'm aware of that. But I'd also say in terms of a Sinn Féin-led government, I mean, if there is one, who knows, as you say, the polls are unpredictable. Any party that leads a government is going to find it much harder to put together with independents. Also, I think political parties can provide a more coherent opposition, as I think Sinn Féin generally have done over the last 5 years. And I also think that smaller political parties like Labour and the Greens have made a big impact in Ireland over the decades in terms of Labour nudging things a bit to the left of centre as a small party in a big government. And the Greens have had an impact on environmental issues. So I'm not at all saying people shouldn't vote for independents. I'm just saying that there are those who say let's have lots of independents because they don't have a party whip. I'm saying, on the other hand, backbenchers play a noble and important role in our democracy to get programmes through.
Do you know what one of my favourite things, Brendan, is watching Professor Gary Murphy's face when people are giving political analysis about independence?
Okay,
I was really enjoying that. To all the listeners.
You know what we do now? Actually, what we get, Professor Gary Murphy is writing today about coalitionology, actually, and gives a good overview of the potential situation. So where are we at with the coalitionology at this stage, Gary?
Well, first of all, on independence, Ireland is really unique in the West, in Western Europe, with the bloc of independence. I mean, name an independent who got elected in the British general election. I mean, there are very few and far between. France, Germany, the Netherlands, all across the Europe.
So some guy came over from Belgium, I think, or something, to help out with that. You know, that that who would you vote for mechanism.
Yeah, yeah.
And he wrote an interesting piece there last week, the week before. The guy was baffled by Irish politics.
And I've lost count of the number of journalists from across the West, Western Europe, who've contacted me saying, tell me why Ireland doesn't have a far-right party and why Ireland has lots of independence. Now, on coalitionology, so Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, because they went in 2020, it looked like they would happily go in again. It mightn't be what they want, but they're sanguine enough to know this is really the only chance. And then, you know, do you do it with the Greens, with Labour, with the Social Democrats perhaps, or with independents? For Sinn Féin, and this is what I was writing about today, it's very difficult to see, and on the numbers you just discussed, Brendan, which it's tightening certainly, but it brings us to something like what happened in 2020, where it was 24%, 22% and 22.5%, I think, for the three main parties. So if Sinn Féin, no, if Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael rule out going in with Sinn Féin, look, how do they get to 88? So Sinn Féin plus the Greens plus the Social Democrats plus Labour plus People Before Profit plus Aintu might get you 88, and you might need a few independents on top of that. And that would just be
88 the magic number.
88, yeah, because we have 174 now.
More TD, we needed more.
Yeah, so yeah. I think 88 for a stable. And that would only give you a 1 or 2 majority. So wouldn't I, 176.
Yeah, they'd want a few independents there as well then for comfort, I think.
That's the point about the independents then, doesn't it?
That is the root of power for Sinn Féin. Now, if Sinn Féin, and my point
is, when the people speak, Gary, and if the people decide that Fianna Fáil and Sinn Féin is what they want, if that's an interpretation of the result, Do people not have to be listened to then, and do Fianna Fáil have to like suck it up?
Well,
or Fine Gael and Sinn Féin.
The leader of Fianna Fáil has already ruled out going in with Sinn Féin. Now, he also ruled out going in with Fine Gael back in 2020, and we know what happened there. But I suspect it will be a cold day in hell before Micheál Martin leads Fianna Fáil into a coalition with Sinn Féin. Now, I could be completely wrong, but for Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, it's obvious. We've done it before. We did it relatively successfully. We don't particularly like each other historically, or maybe even culturally, but we can get to 80 seats, let's say, 40 each, which I think is a reasonable expectation. And then to get 8 is much easier than Sinn Féin's route to power.
Okay. Let's talk about a couple of issues for a few minutes as well. So, Sheena, I've been struck, am I right, that it felt like in the last election campaign, we heard a lot more from from and about the younger generation locked out of the housing market, crippled by rents, social contract gone for them, all the things that you've talked about here. It felt like that was much more of a presence in the campaign the last time. Does it feel like we haven't heard as much of their voice this time, of the voice of people like you?
Yeah, yes, it does feel that way, actually. But we're on a shorter election cycle, and the next 5 days are going to be serious. Like, as Gary pointed out, I think it's a quarter of people still making up their minds. A big, big chunk of that quarter are young people. And when I say young people, I'm kind of referring to those kind of under 40 people, many of whom, you know, have no access to the housing market, is one of those kind of primary, kind of key social, pieces on the ladder. And the thing is, because of a short election cycle like this, we're probably, and actually Mandy Johnson has a good piece in the Business Post about this, which is looking at the fact that some of those really big strategic pieces, housing, infrastructure, water, energy as well, often get left behind in an election like this. But yes, as you say, young people really will be making up their minds, I think, in the next couple of days. I think the Tuesday night debate on RTE with the three leaders of the largest party, Sinn Féin, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, that will, I think, focus on some of those younger, what are considered younger people's issues. When we all know, of course, housing is a crisis affecting everybody in society, including not just the parents who have the kids of 30 living with them, but those people who are living on the street and those living in houses
and
homeless
accommodation.
And
look, I think it's regarded as the root of all evil, really, isn't
it?
On the debate,
that's okay.
But
could I just make a point on the housing question
course,
that you
yeah.
have? Sorry, not to mention our readers panel again, but we did
gather them
at the end of the week this week to ask them about the campaign. And one of the really interesting things that came out of it is that the line in the sand on housing here, if you are a voter and you're figuring out what party you want to vote for, you either go with Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, who want to keep the schemes, the Help to Buy scheme,
okay,
or you go with the opposition and their variety of schemes. Are you willing to take a chance on a new scheme that you have no experience of, or do you want to keep these schemes that are heavily criticised? That's not much of a choice. And what the readers kind of fed back to us when they were asked, do you think that there is a viable alternative to the government? A lot of them felt no, that they didn't feel that there was an actual. So I got the impression that there are some people who haven't yet bought into the Sinn Féin housing plan, this idea that if you're on an income up to €90,000, you will own the house and the state will own the land, effectively. And there seems to be a little bit of reticence around
so
that.
So that enough doubt has been sown in that plan by the opposition. Can I ask you about something else about and again, yep, not to put too much in your readers' panels either, but you can get interesting insights from people on this. So in that poll today, it suggests housing is the main issue in the Sunday Independent. It suggests cost of living is the second issue, with 18% of people giving that as their major issue. Is the cost of living coming up a lot on the doorsteps? Is it coming up a lot in your reader panels?
From being out canvassing, the cost of living is coming up absolutely everywhere. And it's a mixture of cost of living, personal finances, the state of the economy, the future economy. So there's a really broad kind of bracket there as well.
Yeah.
Another interesting thing from the campaign that I noticed just in the last few days, in the beginning of the campaign, it seemed that immigration as a topic was much further down the list. And in the last couple of days, what I'm hearing is actually that it is coming up more than maybe commentators would have noticed or given due credence to.
Or wanted to give due credence to, possibly, let's face it.
Yeah,
there was a general conspiracy among people that this should not be an issue. Okay, before we leave this, Gary, just the debate on Tuesday night got mentioned a few times there. Alison O'Connor has a good piece about it today. Will the debate, as Sheena and Jennifer are suggesting, be very important, that final leader's debate?
One would tend to think so, with the quarter of people still to make up their mind. But in my piece last Sunday week, I went through the history of debates. The first one was with Haughey and Fitzgerald in 82. But the dial doesn't move very much after large debates. In 2007, Bertie Ahern and Enda Kenny, there was certainly a shift. And I think Ahern was seen as having won that debate quite convincingly. Micheál Martin did better in 11, I think, than many people expected, and maybe saved Fianna Fáil from a complete meltdown. In 2020, when Mary Lou MacDonald forced her way onto the RTÉ debate, and I mean, RTÉ had no choice but to include her because it would make no sense, considering Sinn Féin were a level in polling with Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. But again, there was no great move after that debate. So instinctively or intuitively, you would say yes.
Yeah, you'd argue though
her
getting on
move.
To that debate and her being there and everything was part of a momentum too.
It was, but it didn't
put Sinn Féin 3 or 4% over.
Okay,
over
those the are top. The debates online are very much about the party sentiment. And ultimately, while you might feel something about you know, Simon Harris or Micheál Martin or Mary Lou, how that tracks then in your local constituency of Longford Westmeath or otherwise into a party political decision to vote for that party based on the leaders' debate is much more tricky.
Yeah,
it's about the sentiment of where they go after ones and twos rather than who's maybe getting one and two.
Jennifer, can
maybe just don't make a big mistake. So
it's the gaffes you're trying to avoid.
Okay. Jennifer, can I just before we leave the election, ask you about Colin Murphy has an interesting piece in the Sunday Independent, because this has been part of the conversation as well here, and we've alluded to it today when Gary was doing his coalitionology. Colin Murphy asking, can Green Labour and a Sock Dem pact change Irish politics? Like, you're saying your voters see no alternative.
No viable alternative. One that they kind of genuinely believe that has the potential to form a government or represent that kind of opposition that they want. But on that question, the Labour Party are dead serious about this. You know, I'd kind of during the week, I'd bumped into a couple of them and kind of said jokingly, this left alliance will ever happen. They genuinely do envisage it. The thing is, the Sock Dems, Social Democrats, they don't want anything to do with it. And I know different people have speculated about, is it because of their ideology? Is it because of their identity? I genuinely believe the reason why they want nothing to do with it is because they still believe the Labour brand is toxic and they don't want anything to do with that. That's my impression.
Okay.
I think it's more it might be that they feel like Sock Dems will feel consumed under the Labour banner, and that because Ivana Bacic was the leader to come out to suggest this left alliance, that to agree with it is kind of going in underneath her
Colin
leadership.
Murphy's suggesting it's a kind of a cultural issue between the two. The Greens have said they will talk to anybody, essentially, haven't they? They are kind of monomaniacs in the sense that they just want to be in government getting green things done. So
could I just say about the Greens as well, because one of the small percentages in the detail of the Sunday Independent poll is in answer to the question which party is best placed to tackle climate change. The Greens get 45%, and the next nearest party data is at 12%. So we have a world in which there's a disappointing outcome in COP. We have Storm Bert going over Ireland. We have Valencia.
Absolutely.
And there's some sort of disconnect there between the fact that almost half the people in the poll see the Greens as best placed.
And they're at 3%.
And yet they're at 3% of the poll.
Yeah. I'm sure it's been ongoing for years, that situation. I'll just say at the end of all that, we did mention some various candidates, and the full list of candidates in every constituency are included in constituency profiles on the RTE News website, and you'll find them at rte.ie/constituency. So we'll take a break. Jennifer Bray, Sheena Cahill, Bobby McDonough and Professor Gary Murphy staying with us. Okay, welcome back. Our panel is still here. Jennifer Bray, Sheena Cahill, Professor Gary Murphy and Bobby McDonough. Bobby McDonough, you have picked a piece in the Sunday Times, On the Edge of Destruction, or Posturing for Peace, by Mark Urban. So it seems that Ukraine is, things are escalating on one hand, things are not looking good for Ukraine on the other hand. And on the other hand, I have never seen across the international media and everything so much discussion now about potential plans for peace, the idea of a demilitarized zone between them and maybe coming to some kind of settlement that would be acceptable that for Trump and Europe, and that Europe might actually have some leverage in this because Trump does not want to put, say, soldiers into a DMZ. So he would be reliant on Europe for that. Are things looking kind of slightly closer to the end here?
Well, I think there's a sort of paradox, because you have the escalation of the war, as you say. I mean, you have 10,000 North Korean troops brought in, and then you have the Americans, the British and the French giving the Ukrainians a bit more flexibility on the use of their weapons. But you have Trump coming in, and he's completely unpredictable. I mean, some of the things that he said before would suggest that he's in Putin's pocket. But on the other hand, people are speculating that he mightn't exactly go along those lines. So I think we are reaching the point where either things will get a lot worse in the battlefield, or there will be some attempt to find a way through it. And in brief, all I can say is that there will not be a solution by simply conceding to all of Putin's demands. I mean, if the idea is that he takes over part of Ukrainian territory, that Ukraine doesn't join NATO or get equivalent security guarantees, and that Putin effectively in time takes over the rest of Ukraine, then the war will go on. But if there was an appetite on all sides, that's a huge if, and it would require pressure on Putin, then maybe over the coming months. And if Trump place the thing fairly, which is a big question mark, then we might see some progress towards a solution.
OK, and with your policy of optimism, as in all things, do you see a deal to be done?
I think in life deals have to be done. Yeah. I mean, there can't be a permanent war. But I would go back to what I said, that if there is a deal, it must respect the views of the Ukrainian people. I mean, Putin's has an absolute position. He wants effectively to control the whole of Ukraine so that they can't defend themselves, they can't join the European Union. That isn't a solution. Okay. But I think there is a solution available if honest brokers, including the European Union, try to find a solution.
Okay, I'm going to take that as cautious optimism from you there, Bobby. Another very important shift that's happening, Jennifer, and Declan Lynch is writing about it in the Sunday Independent today. Blue sky, the mass exodus. Blue sky is the metamorphosis we need.
Is it though?
Is Twitter over?
I mean, I guess it is to a certain extent. I'm not going to lie, when I see that there's a new platform being set up to join, my heart kind of sinks. I'm already trying my best over on Instagram to find our mystical younger
readers.
And
your Instagram is great.
Thank you.
Yes.
It's what one of my nieces told me. It's so cringe. I was like, oh, God. Oh, please. But no, I am going to join Blue Sky. I actually forgot the name of it there, so that shows you how down to kids I am. Blue Sky.
It'll be tripping off the tongue soon.
Blue Sky. The thoughts of it, Brendan, I'm not looking forward to it.
I think it's really important, actually. I think this is a different shift. As someone who's permanently on the internet, you know, we and people will be sick of hearing, you're dead right, exactly like you, what's this other channel and why am I dealing with it? Tom Dunn has a great piece on page 17 of the Times, just talking about him. He's abandoning X and he's going, which is formerly Twitter, for anyone who doesn't know, and moving to this new platform that looks pretty much exactly like old Twitter did, and it's called Blue Sky. But previous to that, we've had two other moves in recent times. One was to Mastodon, and then to Threads, which was an Instagram-owned platform. And for everyone who's just losing, completely turning bored with everything I've just said, I think the piece we need to think about is ultimately, and we've talked about the general election today at length, and we know how important social media is in influencing our attitudes, influencing our thinking, influencing what we buy, who we see, how we talk to them, or even our language. But one thing Tom pointed out, which I think was just very salient, but very obvious, which is that the platform we choose to be on will soon say as much about us as our newspaper habits once did. And that genuinely is going to be a fact. And the reason why I'm saying that is because ultimately, X, as people know, is owned by Elon Musk, who, you can make
You've
your
got
own
10,
position.
10 seconds to wrap it up there.
And I'm not going to go into Elon Musk then in 10 seconds, but to say that there's a moving apart of the social media platforms. So people who remain on X, it will end up being more conservative and more right wing.
This is going to be your identity now.
It already has been. And okay. I think we have to take everything we see online with a pinch of salt.
But okay, there's as good a place to end as any.
Pinch of salt.
Take it all with a pinch of salt. Jennifer Bray, Irish Times political reporter. Sheena Cahill, account director at DHR Communications. Bobby McDonough, former ambassador to the UK and the EU. And Professor Gary Murphy, professor of politics at DCU. Thank you all very much for that very stimulating hour. And now at 12 noon, we will go to the newsroom.